Okay, so we are at March 13th, 2018, the 26th of Adar, Tafshin Ayin Ches. We're up to Musar Day of Perek Tesvav, and I had some trouble finding some material for this morning. Most of the, if you look in all of the Drush Svarim, all of the Svarim that are trying to do sermonize this part of the Torah, Parshas Metzora. So Parshas Metzora itself is somewhat difficult, but most of them are focusing on the first part, on the Tara process, on the purity process, perhaps on the tshuva process that a Metzora goes through. And all of a sudden we get to this last parak, and it seems, in truth, it doesn't have that much to do with the previous action. The only thing it really has to do is that it is imposed tuma from Hashem. That's what it is discussing. But not about saras, not about that. Rather, it's really a basis for the laws of family purity and sort of the basis for a hashkafa having to do with sexual matters. So with that, got a few things together, and we'll see where we get to today. So in Pasuk Tesvav, we actually have a very Pasuk Aleph and Beis. So Aleph starts off well enough. Vayidver Hashem Moshev Aaron Lemor. So we have that, even though sometimes it says chapter 15, page 628. Vayidver Hashem Moshev Aaron Lemor. So that starts simple enough. Often it's Vayidver Hashem Moshev Lemor. Here's Vayidver Hashem Moshev Aaron Lemor. Okay, but then it says Dabru El Bnei Yisrael. Speak to Bnei Yisrael. So that's a little unusual. Usually it's Daber El Bnei Yisrael, but here is the phrase that is actually unique in the entire Torah. Vidabru. V'yamartem alihem, and you plural will speak to them. So what is the you plural will be speaking to them? Is there anything that is to be deduced from that interesting formulation? So there are, so the Netziv, and as I saw something idea from Rav Schwab as well as from the Netziv. So Rav Schwab says perhaps that everybody needs to know it well, that Martam Alehem, make sure that you have it, that you have this part told. And I would add in, because a lot of the matters that I taught about over the course of this parak, you know, one learns in Chassid and Kala classes, so those often are not taught in a very open and in matter going on. If one doesn't get Hilchos Shabbos early on, so the rabbi will often give Hilchos Shabbos Yerim. In the laws of family purity, so yes, it's true, it should be taught, and there should be a time devoted to reviewing the laws of family purity, etc., but it's not as open, it's not as clear, and one is not going to be able to pick it up by watching other people. So therefore, V'yamar Tem Alihem, both of you make sure that you spread the word and make sure that everybody knows it well before you move on. There's another idea that is taught by the Netziv himself. The Netziv picks up on this language. The Netziv in the Ha'emek Davar, and he says, "Yeah, it's interesting that this language is unique." And then he says that perhaps the idea is el kapi shekasha ledaber beinei ziva v'kari shehu be'ever v'nevashem problem machshava v'hainu savurim sheyoser tov l'mayit hadibur v'talon behem. The Netziv says that maybe one might get across this parak, and they might say, you know what, maybe it's a good idea that we not teach this so openly, we not teach it so widely, that we keep it quiet. V'rak Moshe hu muchach lomod l'Yisrael ha'kabbalah sheyesh lo bal peh. And maybe only Moshe Rabbeinu should teach this, because he's the one who is... He has the tradition, and therefore it shouldn't be lost. We have to be very careful about teaching it. But after we learn it, maybe there is no mitzvah to keep working on it like other areas of Torah. Here, maybe just learn the halachos and then move on, as opposed to in other sections where you work on it and you learn it well, and we learn various levels of interpretation, etc. So says the Emek Davar, no, you should be focusing on this part of Torah as you would any other part of Torah. Yes, true, it might be dealing with issues of tznius, it might be dealing with issues of modesty, that maybe we don't spread so widely and spread so openly. Says that if it's going to be in the context of Torah, it should continue to be taught as openly as possible. And the truth is that was the Netziv's shita. That was the shita of the Velazhen Yeshiva, which the Netziv was Rosh Yeshiva of. That in the Velazhen Yeshiva, they didn't have Yeshiva Shemesechlas, and nowadays it seems like even Yeshiva mostly focus on the areas of Nashim and Nezik, and other areas of Halacha, of Gemara, not necessarily focused on so much. In the Velazhen Yeshiva, they learned from
from beginning to end. That the entire gamut of the Talmud was open to all Talmidim. And when I learned Hilchos Nida the first time for Smicha. I wasn't married at the time. There are some yeshivas that won't teach Hilchos Nida unless one is already married. So my yeshiva. I went to YU. YU is somewhat patterned loosely after the Volozhin yeshiva. They actually shared the name. What name are they sharing? So, the name yeshiva. The Volozhin yeshiva was officially known as the Eitz Chaim yeshiva. When YU was founded, even though now it's known as Yeshivas Reveinu Yitzchak Elchanan, it was originally founded as Yeshivas Eitz Chaim in America. So there is some connection there. There's a connection in terms of the family that the Soloveitchiks were in the Volozhin yeshiva, and then the Soloveitchik, of course, was yeshiva in YU. So there are some connections. And the idea is that one should teach from beginning to end Torah, one shouldn't be embarrassed. This is not, even though the Netziv says it here, this is not the widely held view. It's not... And there's different levels to it. There was a podcast available, if you're interested, a podcast called Headlines. There's someone named David Lichtenstein. This is somehow loosely connected to the OU. And he has something like 20,000 listeners a week. I mean, this is a pretty impressive thing. Every week he covers a different topic. And recently, one of the topics he covered was the issue of yeshiva curriculums. What should be learned in yeshiva? So a lot of it was focused on how appropriate is it to teach secular subjects and stuff, and are yeshivas that are not teaching secular subjects, is that appropriate, is that inappropriate? That was a lot of the discussion. But part of the discussion he also had, it's a long program, it's an hour and a half, 2 hours long, but you can listen to it in high speed. But part of the discussion was about teaching these matters. That really is a difference of opinion between the yeshivish world and the chassidish world. The yeshivish world, it is understood that you learn, even though maybe you won't learn Hilchos Nida until one is married, we do learn Hilchos Seder Nashim, and Seder Nashim is certainly filled with... I don't think it's possible to get through learning Seder Nashim without knowing the birds and the bees as well. But in the chassidish yeshivas, they really... From what I understand, leave it out. That was the impression that I got from this program, that they kind of leave that out of the curriculum. They save that area of halacha to be learned after one has already gotten married. And that's part of the challenge. So one of the things that David Lichtenstein was arguing is that what a great way to learn it, meaning if you're a teenager, so better to be focused on these areas of halacha, and that's a good way of learning the birds and the bees, rather than to leave it totally silent and not to... And the Hasidic person was saying, well, okay, but we're able to maintain a wall. And that's a little unclear. Are they really able to maintain a wall? They're not able to maintain a wall. But that machlokas is out there. And then I don't remember hearing him quote when I listened to that podcast, but on this podcast I listened this week, he seemed to... So one of the proofs, what's the biggest proof that these issues should be learned? That the Torah is not really bashful about teaching these halachos. Forget about the fact that it's in Gemara. Where do we find areas of sexuality discussed for the first time, right, in the Torah itself, right? The Torah doesn't seem to be hiding these sections. So should we be leaving out the story of Yehuda and Tamar over the course of Bereishis? We didn't leave it out in this class, but should we be leaving out references to what Adam and Chava, the relationship that Adam and Chava had, and that was had by the various Avos and Imaos? So of course not, right? Certainly not. We certainly wouldn't leave it out. So apparently he found the Chumash that actually cuts it out. So he was telling that in the Ger community, one of the Ger yeshivas have a Chumash where they've cut out various parts of the Chumash that they distribute to the younger children. And then he opened up the next podcast by playing a recording of somebody yelling at him from the Ger community. How dare you besmirch our community, etc. So he apologized. I love Ger. I use the Oz of 100 Gemaras and the Masifta Gemara. All comes from the Ger, not Ger, Square. The Square community, I love you. It happens to be that they have this Chumash out there, and whatever, take it or leave it. So anyways, that's a major issue of dispute amongst the out there in the Torah world, and some of it, and the Netziv was obviously on one side of that debate, uses this pasuk to perhaps support his view.
Which, the fact that it says that you plural?
You plural, that makes sure that, and he interprets that to mean that makes sure there's extra emphasis, and you should not dilute this from other areas of Torah, etc. Okay, what else do we have? So the Chidushi Aleiv, Rav Rav Henoch Leibowitz, who's Rosh Yeshiva of Chafetz Chaim, so he quotes the piece of Torah here in the beginning of the Mishnah. The Mishnah tells us, the Mishnah in the beginning of the third parak of Pirkei Avos, Akavya ben Mahalalel Omer. So Akavya ben Mahalalel himself is an interesting character, but this is also a prominent, I think, a Yesla Rosenblatt composed piece. Familiar? Anyone familiar with the old? This is like a famous Chazanish piece, this Mishnah. Histakel bishlosh advarim. I look at three things. What are they? Ve'ina tabali de'aver. If you look at three things, you will not come to an aver. Da mi ayin bata ula ana taholeich. Know from where you come and from where you're going to go. Ve'lefi mi ata asid litin din v'cheshbon. That and know in front of whom one day you're going to have to give a full accounting. So mi'ayin bata. So where do you come from? So mi'tipas rucha. So you come from a putrid drop. Where do you go? You're going to go to a place of dust, rima v'soleya. You're going to go dust, worms, and maggots. In front of whom are you one day going to give a din v'cheshbon? You'll give it in front of a God, the King of Kings, Hashem. So Rabbeinu Yonah, if I recall correctly, I don't have it in front of me, but Rabbeinu Yonah is his interpretation of this Mishnah. So he says, what does it mean, mi'ayin bata, so mi'tipas rucha, from this putrid drop? What's that supposed to teach? That's supposed to teach the idea of not to be a bal gaiva, to teach the midah that you're going to lose arrogance, you realize where you came from nothing, so you're not going to be arrogant. And where are you going to go? You're going to go to a place of dust, worms, and maggots. So that teaches what? So that teaches what he refers to as histapkus. That be happy with what you have. Now, the truth is, you might be able to switch the two. I'm not sure why each one is unique to what you have, but be happy with what you have now, because you're really gonna, you're not gonna have anything in the future anyways. You're gonna lose it all. You don't take. as I heard one rabbi say recently, nobody attaches a U-Haul to the back of a hearse. Good point, right? All right, you're not going to be able to take it with you. So, what's the? So what's the point? And then the last one is, and who you're going to go in front of, you're going to go in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that teaches the idea of Yiras Shemayim. So the assumption that what Rav Henoch says, the assumption is that you need all of them combined in order to do what you're supposed to do. That Yiras Hashem isn't good enough. Midos Tovos isn't good enough. That the first two are teaching Midos Tovos, be happy with what you have and don't be arrogant. And the last one is teaching Yiras Hashem, but each one is not going to be good enough in all situations. Yiras Hashem without Midos is going to leave a person imbalanced, and Midos without Yiras Hashem is also eventually going to leave one imbalanced, and that also perhaps finds its idea in some of the sources within this parak. Okay, another idea that is came across, and that is Sefer, I forgot that I had it. So I took a look today as I was fishing around. There's a Sefer Aleinu L'Shabeach. Aleinu L'Shabeach is just a collection of things by Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein. Familiar with Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein? Did that name ring a bell? So Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein is he is the son-in-law of Rav Eliashiv. But he is known throughout for having, I mean, he just publishes tons and tons of stuff. People send him shaylas from all over the world, and he publishes them all. He publishes them all also in a very concise way. He's filled with stories and just interesting tidbits and wild questions that are asked. If you ever need anybody in this room ever needs to give a shiur, short notice, just open up one of his farm and you'll have an interesting topic to give a shiur on. Any page should be good. So anyways, so I looked at, does he have anything on Perek Tesvav of Vayikra? So he had one thing, not really based off of this, anything in the Pasuk itself, but still, I think it works, that the Pasuk tells us, did I write it down here? Yeah. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Musar Hashem Bini al Timas. That the Musar of Hashem, my child, one should not neglect. So what does it mean, Musar Hashem Bini? What is the Musar of Hashem that one should not neglect? What does the Pasuk mean in Mishlei when it says, don't neglect the Musar that is coming from Hashem? So he says, what is the Musar from Hashem? So he says, Bini. The word Bini is the Musar that's coming from Hashem. So what is the Musar of being known as, of being called Bini, of being known my son? So now you make the drasha. What is the musar coming out of that?
Your father.
And therefore,
you have to respect all the things that a father. father is entitled to the relationship.
Okay, so number one says, Sam, remember that Hashem is your father, and therefore there's an idea of kivud aveim, there's an idea of respect, and all of those things that one owes their father. And what's the other idea? What does the word actually mean? My son. All right, and what's the mussar of being my son? That you're a son of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that you're a son of Hashem, and that raises one up to a higher level. So he tells the story here of a Talmud Chacham Echad, that one of the summers he went and he learned by one of the Gedolei Ador, and one time he stopped and said, and Talmud Chacham said in front of the Gadol, what is a good way to help people, Bizman Hazeh, that any place you turn there's thoughts of Avera, and there's images and pictures and all these types of things that perhaps leads one astray. So what is the best way of avoiding that challenge? So the Gadol thought for a moment, and he said, Musar Hashem, this idea, Yesh Sichos Musar Sheshomim Mimashkiach B'Yeshiva, that there was a Sichos Musar that he once heard from the Mashkiach in Yeshiva, Yesh Musar Sheshomim Mechaber Tov, Yesh Shalom De Musar B'Toch HaSfar Misamim L'Kach, that people can learn Musar because they hear the rabbi talk about it in Yeshiva, or they can hear a Musar because they read it in a good book, a good Musar book, that there is one word of mitzvah of Musar that comes directly from Hashem. What is that? It's one word, bini. That's the Musar that Hashem tells a person, that you are my son. So al timas, and therefore don't ruin it. What does that mean? Al tachtis etz atzmacha l'dvarim she'yamisu otcha. Don't lead yourself to ways that you will debase yourself. She'yichlu es nishmosecha, that will mess up your soul. Ki ben shel melech eino holich bavutz. Because a son of a king doesn't go to dirty places. V'imhu niskal pam b'shlushes she'yish bavutz, hu okef es hamakum ahu, k'dei shemachlisa v'vigdei ahud shelo lo yitnefenu. And if a person ever finds themselves there, they leave immediately because they don't want to get themselves dirty. So yimanachlu, if we recognize the idea that we are the sons of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so we will never find ourselves in these types of situations. So that's the words from Zilberstein over the course of this parak. Okay, and then I have one more thought that's out there, and I'm a little hesitant about it because it's I'm not sure we're ready for it in this room. What do we think? Okay, so the Gemara tells us the following. So we learned over the course of this parak four types of tumah that are mentioned over the course of this parak, and there's other types of tumah that are mentioned over the course of this parsha. So number one was the idea of, over the course of this parak, we had the idea of a zav and a keri, right? A male who has some type of seed that comes out, some type of moisture.
Discharge
that comes that is not a normal discharge. The second thing that he talked about is a keri, which is the normal semen discharge that a man will put out. And then there's a zav, and then a nida, as well as a zava of a woman. But that also is considered her discharge, either normal or abnormal discharge that is coming from the woman. Then there's other types of tumas, well, tumas of mitzora that we have had already, a tumas mace, etc. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos, what I find, I didn't see too much discussion about it, but it is a pretty, I think, a pretty big deal. The Pasuk tells us, Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, this is in Brachos Daf Chaf Pei Zaman Aleph, Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Asan Rabbi Yehuda kehilchos derech eretz. Is that Rabbi Yehuda was allowed to hilchos derech eretz? The way of that he wanted to teach the way that a keri is supposed to be involved in things. What is that talking about? So the Tanya. So we learn in the following brayse. You're going to tell your children. And it says right after that, if you'll let your children know about the day that you stood in front of Hashem in Har Sinai. So we connect those two psukim to say, Ma'ala Holon just said, Maimon Har Sinai, the Bnei Yisrael stood, Be'ima V'yiru V'reses U'V'ziyah. The people stood with fear and awe and shaking and trembling. So Afkan, Sobtu, when one learns Torah, you should be Be'ima V'yiru V'reses U'V'ziyah. You should have fear and being scared and shaking and trembling. Okay, so far so good. So then the Gemara continues on and says, Mikan, also from here, Amru, hazavim v'hamitzorayim uvayin alanidos. Those people that are zavim and mitzorayim, right, that they have an abnormal discharge, or they're mitzoras, meaning they had saras, or they have bia with a nida, right? Mutarim likros b'Torah u'nevi'im l'ksuvim. They're permitted to learn Torah. There's no issur in them learning Torah the next day. There's nothing wrong with that. V'lishnos b'mishnah v'gemara v'hilchos v'agadus. And they can learn Mishnah, Gemara, Halachos, and Agadus. They can learn anything that they want. Aval bale kariyin asurim. But if you're a bal kari, it's prohibited. What is it talking about? It's prohibited. So that comes from the Takanas Ezra. That's the idea that any time that a male becomes a bal kari, so they would have to go to the mikvah before davening or learning going forward. And the Gemara is actually putting itself in, finding its source in the pasuk itself. Now that we certainly wouldn't consider that a din d'oraisa, a biblical obligation. It's just finding its source there. That just that by Har Sinai all the Jews went, except for whom? What did we ensure weren't present? So they separated for 3 days before to ensure that nobody was a Baal Keri, that the men and women, neither of them were considered Baal Keri before going in front of Har Sinai. And they say, so therefore you see any other type of tumah, there's nothing wrong with learning Torah, except for a Baal Keri. That's the idea of men going to the mikvah, right? Men go to the mikvah. Where does that idea come from? So it comes from this idea that the Takanas Ezra is that men shouldn't daven or learn until they've gone to the mikvah. We assume that the Takanas Ezra has fallen away, but those that go to the mikvah, in theory, are following that's really where its basis is coming from, Takanas Ezra. Now, those that go to the mikvah daily have expanded beyond Takanas Ezra, right? Takanas Ezra, the rule imposed by Ezra. Ezra set up this rule, a takana, that you're not going to be permitted to do these things until one has gone to the mikvah after becoming a balkari, meaning after having relations, etc. But without that, one wouldn't. So it doesn't really make sense to go to the mikvah every day, right? The whole idea is to sort of make it a little more difficult before one has relations. So you have an interesting thing here, right? All of a sudden, it seems to be putting in a bad light a person who is a Baal Keri. Right? That's what it sounds like. So what does Rashi comment on this? So Rashi makes a comment. Where is it?
It doesn't put it in a bad light, just a special class.
Okay.
Yeah,
but listen to what Rashi has to say. Mikan Amru, from here we say, Kol hatmei mutarim b'Torah, that all of those that are tamei are permissible to learn Torah, Sha'af heim yecholim liyos be'emu v'resas, because they're able to maintain their idea of being in, of awe and fear, or shock and awe. Right? Aval balkeri, eno elemi tochkolos rosh v'zachus adas. But a balkeri, that only comes about through one is having kalos rosh, so one is having levity and lightheadedness, etc. And therefore, because that's what leads one to be a Baal Keri, so therefore that doesn't fit together with being with learning Torah, and therefore you're going to have a problem. Okay? So first of all, just a technical issue to deal with. And that is, on the list of people that are okay, what did we include there? We included one who is a boel, a baal nida, right? One who had relations with a nida. So wait a second. He's also, right, part of that deal is that he also was a baal keri, right? That's the assumption, right? So two answers are given to that amongst the Rishon. One of them is that you could still be a tumas, you could, baal keri, you go to the mikvah the next morning, and you lose your keri status, or at least you've already done what you need to do in order to lose your carry status, and you can go and learn and daven, etc. Your tumas nida, however, is still stuck upon you. So you could still be a tumas nida and no longer a baal carry because you already took care of your carry status and you're still a nida status. That's one technical explanation. The other technical explanation is, he quotes here in the back of the name of the Rambam, that that it's possible also to get tumas keri without ejaculating. I mean, that's just that you become tamei just from the act without necessarily becoming a baal keri along the way. Okay, but anyways, how does one understand this? I mean, how does one understand this idea that you're in a bad place somehow because of the kalos rosh, because of the lightheadedness that is involved? So I looked around. I didn't see anybody comment too much on this. And in fact, in the Sefer Lekach Tov, which is where I first came across this, I mean, he pointed me to the Gemara, the Sefer Lekach Tov, he quotes in the name of Rav Yeruchim, I believe. Yes, Rav Yeruchim in the Sefer Das Torah. And he goes off on how terrible it is to be Kalos Rosh. You see that Kalos Rosh is incompatible with learning Torah. Right? And that's what that's the focus of his statement here. Right? You see how terrible Kalas Rosh is, which you're not going to be able to learn. Torah has to be learned when one is focused and ready and ready to accept, etc. And that's the focus of his piece. But how does one assume that every time one has relations, that's because of Kalas Rosh, and then it's Kalas Rosh is like lightheadedness or a frivolity. Fin in some kind of adjective like that.
It was the first mitzvah.
Yeah.
You know, we're serious about this.
Right. It's a problem. So
didn't this have something about that you totally lost control? I mean, it's lightheaded, but
So there is a piece I mentioned the other day. There is a piece I thought it would be here in the shul. I couldn't find it here. But the Rav has a description where he discusses the idea of sexuality, and he says that at the end that yes, it's true we try to lend kedusha to it, but at the end the act itself is going to be a physical act. So I couldn't. Yes, he talks about David HaMelech here in the piece here as well. So how does one deal with that? So it's problematic, I think. So I looked around a little bit. I saw another piece from the Rav where the Rav talks about, and this is, I think, we could see this certainly from other sources, but he put it together in a very nice way, I think, that the goal is not necessarily to change that act to being it is a physical act. The goal is to turn the physical act into a spiritual act. That it's contained within areas of Kedusha, and it's therefore going to be set and aligned going according to various guidelines. So the easiest thing to compare it to is food. Food as well is the same type of thing. The action of eating is going to be a physical act. You could add whatever kavanos you want to make, and you could do anything you want to do. The act itself is always going to be considered a physical act. Right, so we elevate it by making a bracha beforehand, making a bracha afterwards, looking at what we're going to eat, making sure that it's going to be kosher, making sure that it's that it was shechted in the appropriate way, right? Making sure that no mixtures of milk and meat. Right, we do all these things surrounding the physical act and thereby elevate the physical act. So you would say the same. He would say the same thing with regards to sexuality. We have all so many strictures around it, right, that we take the most physical act and turn it into a spiritual act because of all the things that we're doing surrounding it, right? It's only with one person. It's not you have various rules about who that one person is going to be. It can only be at various times. There's so many restrictions that are around it that it becomes a physical act. But at its very essence, you're not going to remove the idea that it is something that people are doing that is physical, and the way that you get there has a component of kalus rosh that goes along with it. That's just the way it's going to be. So it's not that there's anything. I think you would say, yes, there is kalus rosh. Not that there's anything wrong with it. Right? That's what one is supposed to do. Just keep in mind that midah that is getting you there, the midah of frivolity, happens to be that is incompatible with learning Torah. Learning Torah requires a seriousness that is not going to be there when it comes to that physical act. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's just a reality that exists. And in fact,
so what is a mikveh? It must have some power to stop Kalas Rosh.
Yeah, a mikveh is purifying you in order to put you in another place in order to be able to go ahead and learn Torah. The technical reason for the requirement is the way that it's recorded in the Gemara as well as the Rishonim, the way the Rambam quotes it, is that in order so that Tamidi Chachamim don't become too, aren't with their wives too often. They're not too focused in that direction, which then would tilt the balance. I think that's really the concern. So we want to sort of limit you a little bit by making it a bit of a pain in the neck for you to have relations, in that every time you do it, you're going to have to go to the mikveh the next morning before you go to davening. So we're going to make it difficult in order for you to do, just to make, not to say it's a bad thing, and not to make it that it's something that shouldn't be done, but rather just to make sure that the balance is maintained, and that's really the goal that one is trying to achieve within the those two areas of food and sexuality, which are both contained in the Rambam's Sefer Kedusha, right? The Book of Kedusha. The Book of Kedusha is the book of maintaining boundaries and making sure that our boundaries are set in place and that we don't go too wildly to one extreme or to the other extreme. Okay, so I think that concludes our study of Parshas Metzora, and Emir Sashem Thursday morning we'll be on to the study of Achrimos. You have something to...
Why don't we go by that opinion? You said it would be kind of Ezra's opinion. You
know? So Ezra's opinion fell away because I think it was just too difficult. People were like, oh, I can't go to davening now.
is it Ezra like Nehemiah, that Ezra? Is that...
Yeah, that Ezra.
Okay.
Right.
So why are we able to like disregard
that? Yeah, so how'd that happen? How did it go away? So I think it's not necessarily that it was established, has gone away. I got to look back. The Gemara discusses this at the end of Maseches Bava Kama, I believe, and I think it was what we call a gezeirah she'ir shel lamava. It was just something that people weren't able to maintain. So something that the majority of Jews aren't able to maintain, it gets nullified on its own. I think that's how we understand it. What?
That can happen.
Oh, it happens. Yes, the Gemara tells us clearly by in Maseches Avodah Zarah, which Daf Yomi is learning now. So we have a prohibition of bishul akum. You can't eat things that are cooked by non-Jews. You can't yayin nesach, wine that was touched by non-Jews. And the Gemara says the even asered shemen akum, the asered oil of non-Jews, but that was Yiv Sharlamaba. People weren't able to maintain that, so ultimately that part of the Gezerah fell away.
Just
right, it would be only on Din D'Rabbanan, right? On Din D'Oraisa, so that we can't play around with. Okay, have a good day.